Penguin Random House Audio presents The Book of Cold Cases by Simone St. James. Read for you by Brittany Presley, Kirsten Potter, and Robert Petkoff. For my mother, who didn't get to read this one. Part 1.
Chapter 1. Clear Lake, Oregon. The Greer Mansion sat high on a hill, overlooking the town and the ocean. To get to it from downtown, you had to leave the pretty shops and the creaking seaside piers and drive a road that wound upward toward the cliffs. You passed the heart of Clear Lake, the part of town where the locals lived and the tourists didn't usually go. You passed a grid of shops and low apartment blocks, local diners and hair salons. On the outskirts of town, you passed newer developments, built between the foot of the cliffs and the flat land on the edge of the inland lake that gave the town its name. The land was too wet and rocky to keep building, so the newer developments tapered off into woods and two-lane roads. Along the west edge of the lake were homes built in the 70s, squat shapes in brown brick and cream siding, the gardens neatly kept for over 40 years by people who had never moved away. Past those houses, around the other edges of the lake, there was nothing but back roads, used only by hikers, hunters, fishermen, and teenage kids looking for trouble. In the 70s, the houses along the lake were for the up-and-coming ones, the people with good jobs. Everyone else lived in town. And if you were rich, you lived on the hill. The road climbed on the north side of the lake. The houses were set far apart here for privacy, and the roads were kept narrow and uneven, as if trying to keep outsiders away. The wealthy had come to Clear Lake in the 20s, when the town was first created, looking for a place that was scenic, secluded, and cheap to build big houses. They brought their money from Portland and California and settled in. Some of the houses sat empty after the stock market crash, but they filled up again during the boom after World War II. The people who lived here called the neighborhood Arlen Heights. The Greer Mansion was one of the original houses in Arlen Heights. It was an ugly Frankenstein of a house, even when it was built, a pseudo-Victorian style of slanted roofs and spires, though the walls were of butter-yellow brick. And when Julian Greer bought it in 1950 with his newly inherited pharmaceutical fortune, he made it worse. He remodeled the lower floor to be more modern, with straight lines and dark brown wood. He also put in a bank of windows along the back wall to open up the house's dark, gloomy interior. The windows looked out to the house's back lawn and its drop-off to the ocean beyond. The effect was supposed to be sweeping, breathtaking, but like most of Julian's life, it didn't work out as planned. The windows fogged, and the view was bleak. The lawn was flat and dead, and the ocean beyond the cliff was choppy and cold. Julian had done the renovations in hopes of pleasing his new wife, Mariana, but instead the relentless view from the windows unsettled her, and she kept the curtains closed. She decorated the rest of the house dutifully but listlessly, which was a harbinger of their marriage. Something about the Greer Mansion stifled laughter and killed happiness. It might sound dramatic, but anyone who had lived there knew it was true. By 1975, both Julian and Mariana were dead. Julian with his blood all over the kitchen floor, Mariana in the twisted wreck of a car crash. The house watched all of it happen. Indifferent. Tonight it was raining. A cold, hard downpour that came in from the ocean. Arlen Heights was quiet, and the Greer Mansion was dark. The rain spattered hard on the panes of glass, tracing lines down the large windows overlooking the lawn. The dark skeletons of the trees on either side of the house bowed back and forth in the wind, the branches scraping the roof. Drops pocked the empty driveway. The house was still and silent, stoic under the wind and the water. On the lawn, something moved across the surface of the grass, the touch of a footprint, Inside the house, one of the cupboard doors opened in the dark kitchen, groaning softly into the silence. In a bedroom window, a shape appeared, shadowy and indistinct, the blur, perhaps, of a face. A handprint touched the bedroom window, the palm pressing into the glass. For a second it was there, pale and white, though there was no one to see. The wind groaned in the eaves. The handprint faded. The figure moved back into the darkness. And the house was still once more.
Chapter 2. September 2017. Shay. The day before I met Beth Greer was a Tuesday, with a gray sky overhead and a thin drizzle that wet my face and beaded in my hair as I waited at the bus stop. It was unseasonably warm, and the concrete gave off that rainy scent it sometimes has, rising up from beneath my ballet flats. There was a man standing next to me, wearing an overcoat and scrolling through his phone, with an exhausted look on his face. On my other side was a worried-looking woman who was frantically texting. I closed my eyes, inhaling the scent of the rain laced with a thread of cologne from the man next to me, overlaid with gasoline and diesel fumes from the street. This was my life. It wasn't a bad one. I was 29 and divorced. I lived in a small complex of low-rise condos on a tangle of curved streets with the aspirational name of Saddle Estates. In my mind, I called it Singles Estates, because it was almost exclusively populated with romantic failures like me. People who needed somewhere to live when they sold off their married house and took their half of the money. The man in the overcoat was divorced, guaranteed. And I'd bet money the woman was texting a kid who was in school while spending a court-designated week with his father. My divorce was still new. I had no kids. My place was small, smelled of paint, and only contained the bare necessities of furniture. But it wasn't the worst life I could have. I'd known since I was 9 that I was lucky to have any life at all. On the bus, I pulled out my phone, put my earbuds in my ears, and played the audiobook I was in the middle of listening to. A thriller. A woman in danger. Most of the characters possibly lying. Everything not quite as it seemed. A twist somewhere near the end that would either shock me or wouldn't. There were dozens of books just like it. Hundreds, maybe. And they were the soundtrack of my life. The woman's voice in my earbuds told me about death, murder, deep family secrets, people who shouldn't be trusted, lies that cost lives. But a novel always ends. The lies come to the surface, and the deaths are explained. Maybe one of the bad characters gets away with something. That's fashionable right now. But you are still left with a sense that things are balanced, that dark things come to light, and that the bad person will, at least, most likely be miserable. It was dark comfort, but it was still comfort. I knew my own tally by heart. My would-be killer had been in prison for 19 years, 7 months, and 26 days. His parole hearing was in 6 months. Work was in a doctor's office in downtown Clear Lake. I was a receptionist, taking calls, filing charts, making appointments. As I came through the door, I pulled the earbuds from my ears and gave my coworkers a smile, shaking off all the darkness and death. "Busy day," Karen, the other receptionist, said, glancing at me, then away again. "We open in 20. We weren't bosom friends, my coworkers and I, even though I had worked here for 5 years. The other women here were married with kids, which meant we had nothing much in common since my divorce. I hadn't talked to any of them about the divorce, except to say it had happened. And I couldn't add to the conversations about daycares and swimming programs. The doctors didn't socialize with any of us. They came and went, expecting the mechanism of the office to work without much of their input. I took off my jacket and put on my navy blue scrub top, shoving my phone and purse under the desk. I could probably make friends here.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?